substance, which is quite a tricky one. We have a question here about it. It says, if we use the term substance to describe power when seen as the ground of all that comes to be, then we can say it is infinitely extended. We cannot use the glyph M for this substance unless it has been actualized as form. Is this true or false? We have to be terribly careful here, because the term substance is from, of course, the verb to stand, and a prefix sub, meaning underneath, under. But this same prefix sub is also the same as soup in super. And the reason is a simple one. If we take a sphere and imagine a man standing on top of that sphere, he can refer to what is underneath him as sub stance, that which is underneath where he is standing. Now we're dealing with a concept here of a relation. The relation of a man to a sphere upon which he is standing. In the simple flat earth view, where there's a real belief that there is a down, namely below the feet of a vertical man, we know that in fact this flat earth theory is not true. It consists of not noticing that the horizon is really a curve, and that it's really a sphere that we're standing on, or a spheroid, or a Blake spheroid, we might say, humans. When this man looks towards the centre of the globe, if he were a flat earthist, he would think that he was looking down. That's right, down there. Give us the word only, down, as we shall see later, and the meaning of it. But when we're talking about the metropolis, we always talk about up to it. If we place the smaller cities in a country on the perimeter and the capital city at the center, we always say we're going up to the capital city. We say so because we say we go up to the important thing. Whatever is important we call up, and whatever is less important we call relatively down. Important, we've said before, is simply that into which we carry, import our will. So that those people who carry the will into the capital city in the nation say that the capital is important, and they say they're going up to it. People who live in other parts of the country often talk about going down to it, especially if it's south of the town they're talking about, because they have another idea, another relation, the idea that the North Pole is up and the South Pole is down on the Earth. And we know that Chinese maps are made the opposite way up. They put the South at the top, and everything else upside down too. The important thing to realize is that we're dealing entirely with a relation in the mind of an observer, and this observer is choosing a station point to make his observations, and all his statements are about what appears to be so from his station point. He stands, that's the base star, STA, and below him, sub, is that which he would call substance, that which is below his stance, his observation point. And we also know that if he thought that the center of everybody is terribly important, supposing this were an atomic model, and he stood on the orbit line of an electron, and in the center of this atom there was a protonic complex, you might think that the protons in the center are more important than the attendant electrons, and he might therefore talk about going up to the center of the atom. So whether we say up or down depends entirely on our point of view, and what our will is deciding is most worthy of going to, importing itself into. Now, when we talk about the infinite sentient power, and we use the word infinite, This is the negation of the finite. Not the finite. Finite itself already means a limit, so that we can draw a sphere for that which is finite. And immediately we can see that the possibility of using the concept of substance arises from dealing with the finite. So that when we talk about the substance of things, we are really unconsciously, or consciously, usually unconsciously, referring to some finite, no matter how big. And when we think about what lies underneath all the things we see, all phenomena, then philosophically we might say we are talking about substance. Let's see whether we can legitimately use this. If we frame a sentence in a certain way, we can do. Supposing we say, the substance of all the things that are. Are is part of the verb to be, and already the verb to be has to do with circumscription. We've said before the letter B is really a circle, and we've seen that this old form of the B has various shapes. In the Hebrew it's a sort of tent with a ground line and the back and top, no front. That's the letter B. Other forms are like a square, and so it's like the plan of a house. Its simplest form is a circle. There's an old tradition that said the square letters of the Hebrew alphabet were once circular, and they were squared off when a reed pen was used to write them. We know a similar kind of thing happened with Chinese ideographs when they began to draw them with a certain type of brush, and the form of the instrument of writing conditioned the form of the letters. And so using a square pen, like the reed pen, these letters became squarish. We find the same thing in the German Gothic, the black letter, where the use of a reed pen has tended to square the letters off. Basically, the letter B means a boundary, anything whatever that is finite. So if we talk about the realm of all beings, then we can talk about substance. But we are not talking about non-being, and therefore we are not really talking about the infinite. We are talking about that which is beyond being when we talk about the infinite, the not finite. No matter how big we make the circle of being, and how many sub-beings we put inside it to represent them as circles, we are still within the realm of being if we can in fact define, set the limit of the term we use to refer to it. So if we want to be really careful in the use of terms, we must say the word substance implies finiting processes. Now you may remember that Spinoza based the whole of his philosophy on the concept of substance and a simple equation, God equals substance, or substance equals God. He was searching for the ultimate ground of all phenomena. Unfortunately, he did not notice that in choosing this concept of the ground or substance, he had already chosen a word that is correctly used only of finite, no matter how big. He was led mechanically and inevitably by the laws of thought to say some very funny things about God, because having posited the idea that God is the ultimate ground of all beings, without defining the term ground and knowing that it's from a verb to grind, he had already posited a mechanical necessity in the ultimate ground of being. When he equated God with this substance, he in fact reduced God to a funny kind of machine. But he didn't want to say that he was a machine, because he felt there was something wrong with the concept. So what he said was, instead of God is mechanical, was God acts always by necessity. Now, necessity is a hidden mechanical concept. Instead of saying God is a machine, for which he would have been kicked by the synagogue immediately, he said God is substance, simple equation. God is the ground of all being. Many philosophical writers with a theological bent have said God is a substance. God is the substance of reality. But if God is to be considered as a substance, and the term substance is to be used in its proper significance, We are talking about what is essentially bound. Now, certain thinkers, Kabbalistic thinkers particularly, don't mind saying that God is bound, providing you make a distinction between God and Godhead. And in Christian theology, you get the same use of the term the Godhead. Let's draw a circle and say that circle represents the biggest circle that we can conceive. We will save time by drawing a small circle and pretending it's the biggest circle we would have time to draw if we had all the time there is. When we draw this circle, we have made being. Let's call this being God, and we'll write inside it the two Greek letters L and G together, the lambda and gamma, in the word logos. We've now written logos when we've done a six-spoke wheel. Well, we have the letter L, the letter O, the letter G, another O, and the reciprocal relation between the L, or light principle, and the G, or dark principle. Lambda equals light, and gamma equals dark. These two together, therefore, are representing themselves in a wheel of dialectical opposition. Call this identical with the God referred to in the Gospel of John as the Logos. In the beginning was the Word, the Logos, and this Word was with God, and this Word was a God. In the Gospel of John, it shows the distinction between these two, between the Logos God and the God, because in the one case it says with the definite article, the God, and in the other case without the definite article. So that the indefinite article is not employed there, but the definite article is. As if we were to say, in the beginning was the super God, the Godhead, and this God had with it a logos God, or a rational principle, as one of its functions. And this would be called the second God. This logos is the second God, made by the first God as its only son. When we talk about the only begotten, if we said onely begotten or unifically begotten, the monogenes, the unity generated God, we imply in the fact that we say unity a circle. If we don't draw the circle, we are not talking about unity at all, and if we refer to it as the absolute, we're talking not about oneness, not about unity, but about non-duality, about that which is beyond every finite indetermination whatever. We use the term absolute for this super concept, because absolute means that which is when all else is washed away. When you wash away all the finite considerations that your intellect could possibly conceive, then use for that which remains the term absolute. What remains when all else is washed away? So if we write the term absolute beyond here, beyond this circle, and the term logos in the circle, and call this absolute the God, and the logos God, but not the God, we then have a concept similar to the Godhead beyond the circle, and the big circle within the Godhead. This makes the Father as the God, absolute, and the Son as the Logos. Now we can see that we can talk about this Logos God as the substance of all being. But if we're to use the term substance properly, we should not really talk about substance of the absolute, because the absolute is the God, Father of all, and yet himself is infinite. And he is superstance as well as substance. If the Logos is only substance, the transcendence of the absolute, because it goes under and through the Logos, behold, if you make your bed in hell, I am there, says the text of this super God, and if you make it in heaven, I am there too. This super God, being the absolute, infinite, continuous, sentient power, being infinite, there is nowhere where it is not. So it is running through this Logos God. This Logos God is a substantial God if you conceive a man to stand upon it and look at it. Or if you conceive the forces which are beyond it to be moving towards it in order to create it. If we draw the Logos God in the middle and put the arrows of the absolute energy pressing into the center, we have to say that the Father, the generative power, is moving towards the center to create this Logos God. And of course this presents us with another interesting dialectical concept. In moving towards the center, the force that is doing so is the force we refer to as Saturn. But this Saturn is the devil. Perceiving this, of course, William Blake said, people are worshipping the devil under the name of Jehovah. Because if they worship a creative principle, they are worshipping, in fact, form. That is, the circumscribed, the limited, the bound. So if you worship a concept, no matter how clever the concept is, no matter how logical it is, no matter how much it works pragmatically, if you worship practicality, materially or at a subtle level, or any level whatever, whatever that is form, if you worship that form, you are worshipping the devil. That is to say, the principle of separativity and the creative function that finites the infinite in order to bring to be the time process. This Logos, then, as the formal principle, kept in being by the absolute, the God, is the Son of the Father, where Father is the absolute. This Logos God appears in man as pure intellect. It is called the light that lights every man that comes into the world. John the Baptist said, I am not that light, but that light is to come. John the Baptist signifies the lower intellect immersed in material existence. This Logos of the Christ signifies the one generated, the monogenes spirit of the absolute, making the superlogic of macrocosmos. Now we all participate in this Logos when we are absolutely truthful and clear and logical in our processes. To be truthful is to participate in this. But the moment we start finiting and bending events for our material purposes, we sink to the level of John the Baptist. Now, can we say that the glyph M can be used for this substance? We can say yes, we can use the glyph M because it is in fact the sound made by closing the mouth. So it does symbolize substance, but substance itself only symbolizes a finite, no matter how big. The macrocosmic sphere is still finite. If we draw more spheres beyond it, which we can do in the infinite, and say, all right, if that's the macrocosmos, there's a lot more macrocosmoses outside, and we can draw a big circle around all of these, call it megalocosmos, or any other superlative we care to fabricate. We can say the biggest of the biggest of the biggest, or the whiter than whitest. We just go on as long as we've got words to fabricate and the time to do it. But when we have drawn all the circles, we're still drawing circles. We can still say, in relation to being, substance here is identical for all of them, and the substance is the same thing which, if we rubbed out the lines, would be the absolute. But in inserting the lines in, we bring it immediately into the realm of being, where being equals circumscription, and therefore we can use the glyph M to signify it. So that wherever we are talking about formal existence, it is permissible to use the M, and wherever we talk about anything positive in a definable way, other than the double negative of the absolute, when we talk about the positive in a time sense, we are always talking about form, and we can therefore legitimately call it substance. We can see that when we do take the concept of substance, as Spinoza did, and equate it with God, we fall into this concept of necessary action. Whether we like it or not, the history of the term substance has brought with it an aura of materiality, something we stand upon. We stand upon substance, substance. And that upon which we stand, in fact, ourselves, is the Earth. Now today we're in a position with space flight actually accomplished to know that if we get in an appropriate position in the cosmos itself, in between planets or in between solar systems, we can balance ourselves in a weightless condition. And if you can imagine a spaceman stepping out of his rocket somewhere in between star systems where there is no gravity at all, his own body would be a center of gravity for him and for any stray cosmic dust that would be flying about. Now he would have, as Omar says, neither up nor down. There would be no question to him other than this: I am the center of all I perceive. And he would say, I am going wherever I will to go, and where I will to go I can decide arbitrarily to call up, and where I will not to go I could call down. But if he were a man that wanted to own something privately, he could legitimately call it down and mean up. That is, he could go down like Nietzsche does in his Untergang and say, I'm not falling, I'm going down, where down means to the place of divisions of ownership. The O-W-N in down means just this: to do one's own, to have private purpose. So down means towards the realm of divisions, and up means away from divisions. If we take the Logos center we draw and we move away from it, we're moving away from the center of divisions. So in that sense, the Logos itself is a down. The root DN, like the recent DNA lovely stuff, DN means judge, and Dan means judge, and a Don is supposed to be able to judge. So that when we go to a center of form, we are going to a center of judgment and of division. DN means the motion of division. We draw a circle, we can draw a half circle by drawing a line in it, quarter circle, and so on. We can subdivide this circle, and therefore we're in the land of ownership and in the land of judgment. So when we are moving towards any finite thing whatever, we are moving towards finiting judgments, private judgments. We are also moving away from paradise. Paradise, we remember, means beyond division, beyond duality. Para and dice means beyond duality. So as soon as we move into existence, into anything that is finite and formally determinable, we have left paradise. We have gone out of Eden, which means no judgment, into the land of judgment. Now in this sense, we can see the significance of identification. The popular concept of the Garden of Eden is a place surrounded by a wall. Why the wall is there we don't know, unless there's wickedness outside or a desert. And this is a garden. And we have the idea that Adam and Eve, for some weird reason, are thrown out of the garden and are made to wander about. Let's look at it the exactly opposite way. Supposing that they are thrown out of paradise, out of beyond duality, out of Eden, out of non-judgment, into judgment. Then they're thrown out from the Father Godhead into the realm of temporal creation. They're thrown out of the field into the body. Now we can see the meaning of identification. So instead of thinking about Eden as a small place, we think about Eden as the infinite. And we think about the time process as a product of the rotation of primary forces, producing object consciousness, centerings within consciousness. These centerings, condensing energy, which is the sentient power itself, objectify and thus produce zones of identification with subsequent loss of the infinite consciousness. We can then write the letter M in here for the closed system, and we can see that that M, meaning closed, also means the substantial and the center of individual appetite. Insofar as any individual has an appetite, he has a deficiency. He feels that he must take something to himself, which implies that he feels less than he might be. Now this appetite is focusing onto the object called food. So again, it is a process of identification in the finite temporal world. And we have another aspect here of the same problem of the substance that we've now touched upon with appetite. It is a question about the absolute appetite, the universal appetite. Appetite equals hunger equals lack. Why does creation spring out of hunger? If the absolute hungers, can it legitimately be said to be omnipotent? If creation springs from hunger, can we still consider it a free act? This, of course, depends on how we interpret appetite and hunger. Now, we can tell by the lots of P's in the word appetite that we're dealing with a precipitating concept. There's a P in the middle. Appetite is simply the movement to create objects. The word hunger, of course, means the power is moving into the earth and breaking it up, differentiating it. Now, for man, the finite, hunger and appetite imply lack. But they cannot have the same meaning for the absolute. So that when we say the absolute so loved the world, this love that he has does not imply in any sense that he lacks anything whatever. This is one of the theological problems. If God bothered to create, was it better for him to create than not to create? And the answer is it has nothing to do with better or worse, it has to do with the will. If the absolute hungers, can it legitimately be said to be omnipotent? Now, when we're talking about the term absolute, we have agreed that we shall only use the term absolute to refer to that which is when all private finiting processes are washed away. When we wash all privation away, all lack away, because this private privation means lack. When we remove all lack, then we cannot have any lack left. And therefore the absolute cannot, in any sense, be said to be other than omnipotent. Therefore, if we do use the term hunger and say that God hungers after righteousness in man, hunger must mean a very special thing. It must mean that the power of God moves into the earth to differentiate it. It does not mean a lack in the absolute. What it does mean is that there is a deficiency at the creating end, say the end of the human race, because they have not yet reached their optimal development. This is not a deficiency in the absolute. This is a deficiency in the creature. Supposing we imagine for a moment there's a nerve cell, and this nerve cell is drawing a filament out to reach a muscle in another part of the body. If we watch the movement of this nerve grow, we find a little bulb on the end of the filament drilling a hole through the protoplasm and moving towards the nerve, towards the nerve end plate, which it will grow to fasten on the muscle. But this line that is growing along has no gross material existence whatever. Now the physical body of the man or the baby during the period of growing these nerves, before the nerves are grown, is deficient. The child hasn't grown his nerves properly yet. But all the form that it will grow is already there in the field. The nerve that grows, the prolongation of the cell that grows through the protoplasm and eventually fastens into proximity with a muscle fibre, is actually growing along a pre-existent gradient. This is a fact. The nerve cannot grow from its centre of origin through the protoplasm and fasten onto the muscle correctly with the type of nervous system of a human being without the form of the human nervous system already pre-existing the gross material nerve. What we know about this today, electrically and chemically, is that there is in the protoplasm a gradient, an electrochemical gradient, that the nerve grows along this electrochemical gradient, and therefore the actual path that the nerve takes already pre-exists inside the field of that human being. So we have to say that this field contains all the perfections that will become in the human being. But at the gross material level, before they have actually developed themselves, we must say that individual on examination at the gross level is deficient. But the deficiency is not in the field. It is in the gross material world. So that when we talk about the infinite field of the absolute, we cannot in any sense affirm a lack for it. So that if we do want to use the word hunger for it, as we might if we were being poetic, or even philosophical, we must mean by it something other than a deficiency, such as we refer to when a human being hungers for finite food. The hunger of God for righteousness in man, for the elevation of man to his optimal function, is not a deficiency in God, it is a will. It is a potency in God to push the perfection from the absolute level into the time process and to make deficient creatures efficient, to lift their function. So we have to say to this question, if the absolute hungers, can it legitimately said to be omnipotent? Yes, we must say that it is omnipotent, otherwise we are abusing the term, and also it is legitimate to say not only is it omnipotent, but we can use the term hunger for it, providing we remember that when we define terms, we define the limits of the application of the term, and we shall limit this term hunger, when used of the absolute, to the will to enter into the gross material world to fulfill the deficiencies of the gross material world from the non-deficiencies of the absolute. We have then legitimate use of the concept substance for all finite beings, no matter how big, and this means therefore for the Logos. Now Christ at one point shattered some people by telling them, if you don't eat my body and drink my blood, you will not get into the kingdom. And because he said this, it was a hard saying, it says, and many left him because of this. They thought he was talking about cannibalism. And of course he was. But not in the gross material sense. He was talking about cosmic cannibalism. Now, it sounds like a bit of a joke because cannibal has Cain and Abel mixed up in it. When Christ refers to this body, he's talking about the cosmic Logos body, with which he is perfectly identified. Now if we participate, if we take part in truth, beauty and goodness, that is to say, if we get a true idea or a feeling of beauty or a goodwill in us, this true idea, this feeling of beauty, this goodwill are all simply the functions of this Logos which we have now taken into ourselves, just as if we'd eaten a meal. But instead of coming out of the time process, the energy of this meal comes from the eternal Logos form. In that sense, we can say we are eating the body of Christ whenever we can, in fact, assimilate. We use the term assimilate of material food. We can use it also of spiritual food, that is, ideas. Whenever we can assimilate an idea, we have eaten a bit of the cosmic body. Whenever we can feel beauty, we have participated in the flow of energies of this body. This is the blood. Whenever we have a good will, we have actually participated in the Father power that actually sustains this Logos body of the matter cosmos. Now we have another question relating to this here, which says, does the subtle body have spatial occupancy? Does the subtle body exist in space? If so, at what point does it become causal? Now, when we're talking about space, we have to be very careful. We've done this many times before, but it always needs doing again and again, and always from new points of view. We have said that the word space has an S in it. And whether we say place or space, the constant in these things is S. And this S is simply the H, which has an H in it for English, and an H in it for French. This S concept is simply the concept of the absolute spirit. And if this absolute spirit posits within itself, it does so by simply concentrating energy in points. And this we call a place. It posits and ties up a certain amount of spirit, P-L-S. Posit, tie up a certain amount of energy. That is a place. Now, each place is within the infinite field of spirit, which is called space. So space is infinite, places are finite. And we step from place to place by pace, pacing from one place to another place. Always we are talking about spirit. And as soon as we posit at all, then it is legitimate for us to talk about space. And therefore we can say of the subtle body, as the subtle body is concerned with form, that it has a sense in which we can say it exists spatially. But immediately we have to distinguish between gross material space and subtle space. Wherever we can draw a circle and beyond it another circle, we have posited the P in place, P tight up the little burning. That's a place, tie this one up, that's another place. As soon as we draw, either physically with carbon on the paper or mentally draw a circle in our minds, when we've drawn a circle, we have drawn a place. So, even in the world of ideas, it is legitimate to say that ideas exist in a kind of space. This is the proper use of the term. But we have to observe that these gross ideas do not have the same order of spatial existence as the ideas of the subtle order. So we have to distinguish between two kinds of space. And we can see a very simple illustration of this. Supposing I've got a magnet in my pocket. And that magnet has a gross body, is a little piece of iron. And that has gross spatial existence. But round that, there is a field. But also there is a threshold limit of influence for that field. So that if I put a pin at a certain distance from it, the pin will rush to it. If I put it a bit further, it won't. We can call this the field threshold, if you like. Now this field, which we know is there, we can demonstrate it with the Klein filings or the pins. This field is a subtle form. And this field occupies space, but not at the gross material level. This subtle body is a spatially existent body, but not a gross space. So we distinguish very simply the two spaces when we get two gross bodies together and they have fields around them. A field is a zone of influence. If we start pressing these things together, for instance, I've got a circular magnet which I had made, sawn in half. If you get hold of the two halves, put them together one way, they stick. If you reverse them and try to put them together, they're quite hard to put together because the magnet is very strong, although it's quite small. So when you hold them in your fingers and try to put them together, they wobble. And if you're not on guard, they'll fly. and make a north-south attachment when you're trying to put two norths and two souths together. If I give it to a stranger and say, just put these two together, when they put them together, they slip sideways and they get a shock at the strength of a quite small magnet. Now, this means that the subtle form of the field round the magnet really has a spatial existence, but the space is not gross. If I turn those magnets back to back in a certain way, I can beat them together at the gross level without any resistance. And if I turn them in another way, I find very great resistance. So the peculiar thing about this space of the subtle level, the field level, is that it is polarized in a way that gross material bodies do not appear to be. All the bodies in this room could quite easily, without much effort, lean on each other without experiencing resistances to stop them. And yet, at the subtle level, if you were to reverse polarity and then proceed to put positive to positive and negative to negative, you would find very strong repulsions. Some of these, if you are fairly awake, you can actually feel to exist when two men get too close together. They feel rather funny about it, quite apart from any educational training, they feel a bit strange. This might be considered to be an illustration, not illegitimately, of polarization in the human body. We know that biomagnetic fields exist today. They're very subtle. They're more subtle than iron magnetism. But they are measurable. They have been measured. Now, we can therefore say the subtle body occupies space, but the space that it occupies must not be considered to be of the same kind as the gross material space that we refer to. And yet we know that what we call space between gross material bodies is actually full of field forces, which are too subtle for the gross organs of the body to apprehend. Does this subtle body have spatial occupancy? Yes. If so, at what point does it become causal? Now, we've said before that we use the word will for the point at which the field initiates action. It becomes causal at the point of initiation. Now, we know that the word causal derives from a Latin for strike. This causus, strike, the verb to strike. So when we're using cause, we're getting the idea of hitting an object, and the result is the object changes its behavior. If we hit a billiard ball with a cue, it rolls away. This is the concept of cause. And the subtle body is the term we use for the form of the field. But the causal body is not used for the form of the field, but for the point of the initiation of the mobilizing of the field. So the causal body is not the form body, and this simply means that we do not use the term causal body other than for the moment, in the sense of that we would use it in mechanics, the moment, the turning moment, the moment when action begins. The point of initiation, the causal body, is that level of being where changes are initiated. So if we now draw a gross material body around it a field of form, and that's the subtle body, and around this a body not considered as formal, but considered as pressing in upon this to induce change. Now you can experience this causal body very simply, because you can look at your gross material hand and test it by hitting on something. Yes, that's gross matter. Our term gross matter is used for walls and doors and blackboards, knuckles. And you can close your eye and you can feel, without hitting the wall, that you have a hand. And yet you know that the form of this hand is there by mobilizing it and feeling the shape of the hand as opposed to the elbow, the leg, and so on. You can, with your eyes closed, get a formal experience by allowing the body to move. But when you come to consider what makes it move, then you have to hold your hand still first, and then feel very carefully the form of the hand, and then decide means cut away from, decide out of the infinite possibilities of motion of that hand to actuate one of them, say, and raise your first finger. Now, at the point at which you raise that finger, you will feel that you do something. You will feel what you call an intention. That is, a tension flowing inwards to the finger. Now, the point of initiation is your immediate experience of the causal body. Now, most people never feel at all about the causal body. They feel the gross physical body when somebody kicks it on the shin, or when a deficiency of food causes one part of the stomach to press on another part, which is gross material contact. And they also are aware of ideas, forms, but they are not usually aware of the point of initiation, which is really the causal body. The causal body is the field that contains the subtle and the gross. If you feel very carefully what it means to sit still, so that when you feel irritations in the body tending to move the body, so lift your toe up or get an itch somewhere, you will tend to respond to this irritation by acting. Now, if you deliberately inhibit the response, you are becoming aware of the causal body. Now, this causal body is pure sentient power. It is experienced immediately. The subtle body and the gross body are not experienced immediately, they are experienced mediately. But the experience of the causal body has no mediation. So that when you actually feel in your body and you inhibit consciously a tendency to action, you're becoming aware of the causal body. As you can in fact inhibit a tendency to action, so also you can generate a tendency to action that is not already there. You can decide to move something that is not irritated and doesn't want to move. And when you can mobilize yourself deliberately in the absence of stimulation, then you are immediately aware of the causal body. To become aware of the causal body is to become aware, of course, of the source of all power. Because if we come to consider the nature of the field, we define a field as a zone of influence. And consequently, when we say a field, we have already referred to a concept that is finite. A field, one field. Now, if we refer to the non-dual field, we have to say the influence of the non-dual field is infinite. Now, within this infinite field, which is the Godhead, the Absolute, there are centers of precipitation, and each center is a causal body in its own right. And within this causal sphere, it precipitates a subtle body by simply mobilizing itself and then referring to its own formal aspect of its self-mobilization. This generates a subtle body. This is the body you take with you when you die, the body you had before you were born. This subtle body is mobilized by the causal body, and the causal body is the field, self-mobilizing. And the causal body, a causal body, is simply a finite zone precipitated within the infinite by the infinite. Now, there is no division whatever, in any essential sense, between the causal body of any individual who is causally aware and the infinite field of the Godhead. This means that where you become aware of yourself as a causal being, not a subtle or a gross being, a causal being, whatever you will to initiate or mobilize will be carried into effect by the field. This, of course, is the ground of all magic and willing. The thing that normally stops people from doing this is fear and the consequences. When you start to feel your own causal power, you discover that you are assuming responsibility. Now, if you know that you're a causal being, is there anybody to blame other than yourself? If you find yourself in a situation when you yourself have willed it, the answer is no. If you will a situation, you are responsible. If you consciously will it, you are responsible. And if you will finitely, you are responsible to the infinite. Because the field, infinite, will modify according to the finiting process of the individual causal level. So where we become aware of our causal self, and we do this by pure feeling, we are becoming aware of the infinite field of sentient power in the place where we are. If we say there is a locus for every sphere, this LOC is the same LOC in LOCK, lock. A locus is simply a place where spirit is locking itself up. But it is this infinite spirit that is precipitating all the loci within the universe. And each one is self-generated. This is the non-dual fact, that this infinite sentient power, when it focuses, the part that is focusing is self-focused. So that every being that exists is ultimately responsible for existing, because he is focusing. The realization of this by thinkers of a certain order, quite high thinkers, but perhaps not high enough, has often been suicide. I will out of this focus because this focus has put me on the spot. I'm in trouble. I can get out of this trouble by unfocus. This is perfectly true. You can. What you can't do is cease to be essentially what you are, a causal being. So if you reject the focus in the gross material world, that's only one of the focuses that you have as potentials. You still have infinite potentials and focal points in your subtle body, and these are just as binding as the gross material ones. In fact, it was only because they were binding that the gross material came into existence as a superstress upon the already formal existence. From the point of view of practice, what we have to do is reverse the process of the form. When the serpent goes to Eve, it is a stimulus from outside her gross material body, and not outside the infinite field, because that is impossible. Outside her gross material body, a stimulus comes, that is the serpent. Of course, every stimulus has a forked tongue, that is to say, it is dual, and it can give rise to pleasure pain, liking and disliking. As soon as the stimulus comes, Eve goes out to it and identifies with the external material world. But in the process of focusing on the material world, she has forgotten the infinite force that was coming into her center. She has now dragged all the force vested in herself into the external gross material world. She now proceeds to tell on the intellectual side of her being, that is Adam, that this is a good thing, this externalization of consciousness, this process of identification. He then identifies with the gross material body and loses his field awareness. He moves from paradise, from non-duality, out of Eden, non-judgment, into a zone of duality and judgment, knowing good and evil. And in so doing, he falls under the dominion of all dualizing temporal processes. The whole process being one of identification with anything whatever that is external, formal, and material. To reverse the process, we have to realize that the gross material body is circumscribed, limited, deficient, recognize it as a center of reference, but no more, realize that the subtle body, the body of ideas we have, is just as binding as the gross body, unless we keep it in order. Realize that it has no power if we remove the causal initiative from it. It is simply a grid of form. And then move into the feeling, out of the physical body, out of the idea, into the feeling. Center in feeling and become aware of the infiniteness of feeling, the edgelessness of feeling, and yet although it is edgeless, it has a center. The center is where you focus. When you become aware of this field, you become aware that you can actually move your hand. Now you can move your hand and be surprised that you are able to move it. The more, in fact, that you try to find out how you move it, the more mysterious it is. When a scientist tries to find out how he moves it, he gives it up. He says, let's try something simple, like an investigation of the structure of matter, atomically and subatomically. That's simple, compared with the subtlety of his own will. Because if you try and get hold of your will, you can't. You can feel your own intent, but what you get hold of is not a thing. It is simply the will mobilizing itself to center itself. And what it is, it isn't a what. It's a who. It is sentient power. Let's consider for a moment the concept of the omnipresence and omniscience of God and the concept of pantheism as opposed to theism. A pantheist believes that all nature is God and God is nature, and that there is no God beyond nature. But the theist says all nature is certainly nature, but all nature is formed and therefore finite, and this God that we are referring to absolutely and infinitely transcends nature, whilst being the author of nature. Now in the theist position, as opposed to the pantheist position, quite correct no doubt that the roles have fallen down at this point, if the role represents nature, when we come to consider God himself, then we must talk about that which is not broken, the infinite, and we observe that the definition of God requires three statements to cover its actual capacities. In modern psychology, we would call these the cognitive, affective, and cognitive processes. We can reduce this quite simply to saying, to define a person, we have to say a person is a being that has will, feeling, and ideas. And a being that had no ideas, or no feeling, or no will, would not be a person. Our word person means just precisely these three considered together. Now we have to see whether it is true that this absolute has got these three, because if it has, then we can say truly God exists. By God we mean the supreme sentient power which has these three qualities, which enable it to think, to feel, and to will. We've already seen that thinking, ideation, refers to form. The word idea means form. It's simply the Greek word for form. And therefore, wherever there is a form, we know this form in the field is of the field, by the field. So we say that the process of formation we must certainly attribute to the origin of the universe. So we can say the idea, which is the Greek word for form, can legitimately be applied to this infinite sentient power. This infinite sentient power is a formative power. And therefore we must assert it is a power that ideates, a power that creates ideas. So one third of the definition of person is established. This infinite power does ideate, it does form it. The universe, ourselves, plants, animals, planets, suns, stars, all these are formed. They all exist, and they're all part of the ideational capacities of the infinite power. Then we have to examine whether this power does in fact function as cause. And we remember that cause means strike, and we know that the forces in the universe do in fact strike on each other, and every strike produces a change. So that we have to assert, not only does it ideate, does it formulate, but it also stands as cause, because all the constituent motions in it are impinging on each other, striking upon each other. So we can say it is a causal and a formulating power. Now, to complete the definition of the God and justify the theist position, all we have to add into this is the power of sentience. Can it feel? If it can feel that it ideates and causes, then it is truly a person. And we've seen before that if we exclude sentience from the origin of the universe, we can never at any point reintroduce it. Once we exclude sentience from the original of the universe, we have said the universe is non-sentient, and whether we start from an atomic base or from a substantial continuum base, if we exclude sentience, we can never reintroduce it. We cannot say that if an atom is senseless and another atom is senseless and a million atoms are senseless, that if we arrange these senseless atoms in triangles or hexagons or dodecahedrons, that these arrangements will induce sentience to appear in them. They cannot. And nevertheless, sentience exists. It exists in us and in the animals, and to some degree in the plants. And therefore we have to say that sentience is an essential quality of this source of the universe. So it ideates, that is, it formulates, it acts as cause, it impinges upon and induces changes within its parts, part to part, and it has sentience. And this is precisely the definition of a person, and therefore we have to say that as this sentient power field, source of all, is established in this threefold way, it is legitimate to call it a God. Now, when we come to consider this God, if we draw a circle, we know that there's always an infinity of space beyond it, and therefore we can say that this God, this threefold sentient power, which ideates, causes, and feels itself, being infinite, transcending all finiting processes, whatever, necessarily transcends nature. Nature is a modal function within it, a finiting process within it, but it goes right beyond, which is exactly the theist position as opposed to the pantheist position, where the pantheist would allow that there is a world soul, an atomic soul, a vegetable soul, an animal soul, a man soul. It would allow all these, but it does not allow transcendence. It doesn't allow beyond nature this threefold sentient power being. And therefore, the pantheist view is incorrect, because nature is only Torah. Natura implies a wheel. No matter how big we make the wheel, there is always something beyond it. So the theist position is truer than the pantheist position. And the peculiar thing about the pantheist position is this. If we accepted that there is no transcendence, and that God is nature, then all the processes in nature would be equivalent to mechanical processes. Because a frog form would be a frog. And a frog, by definition, has certain formal characteristics, certain functions, certain ways of behaving. A lion has some other ways. So that once we have defined each life form, we can say, if lions roar and pussycats spit and dogs bark and wag their tails, if we say, is this a dog? Yes, well then it wags its tail, and so on. We can categorize and reduce the world to mechanics if pantheism is true. A peculiar kind of thing, where although it is sentient, it is nevertheless so involved in its form that it can't break the form. Therefore, we want another God outside of the machine of nature to be the occasion of free choice. The lion can't help being a lion, and the toad a toad. But if there is transcendence, it is possible for that transcendence to come in and induce a mutation and change the lion, change the toad, change the man. Now man becomes progressively freer by understanding higher and higher concepts. When he's at the gross material level, like a small child crawling about on all fours, picking up on bits of coal and stuffing them in its mouth, when its object is identified, its actions are very deficient and very limited. When it begins to become aware of other spheres of possibilities, concepts, then it begins to transcend the mechanical processes that previously held it in bondage. And if it can gain a concept bigger than the one it's got, it moves into a higher realm of function. And if it can gain the concept that the Stoics did on the cosmic logos, then it can be reasonable. But if it only goes as high as the logos concept, it can only be reasonable. It can't transcend reason. But if it realizes that no matter how big that logos is, it is still formed, it can go beyond form into the absolute level, which is the same level as the free initiative, an absolute cause. Therefore, when we have this concept of the non-dual, the paradisical, the Edenic, beyond all circumscribing limits, whatever, in the moment we clearly grasp what it is about, and then center in the field, and realize this field is our own being, and transcends all gross bodies and subtle bodies, all forms, whatever, when we feel that we can actually move without inclination, we're at the cause level, and we take our destiny into our own hands, not dictated to by gross material objects or by ideological considerations. We transcend absolutely all limiting factors, whatever.
How is it that he's transcending the concept that you've just gone through, of coming to me, say, as formal vibrations, and yet they transcend the formal vibrational level?
Well, how is it that when you throw a pebble at a pool, the result is ripple? That's to do with the nature of the pool's response capacity, isn't it? Mm. I imagine that the pebble represents an impulse of will. What happens inside you when you are disturbed by a stimulus is simply that because the nature of the stimulus is motion, it animates all the existing formal furniture you've already got, and therefore you reduce to thinking even the word will. What's actually happening, your eardrum is vibrating under a sound of stimulus. This is emotion imparted to you. In the mnemic field, in the field of your memory, with all your formal furniture, your education, your language, your vocabulary, as soon as this formal stimulus comes in, it reverberates through the whole mnemic field and conjures up all related verbalizations, therefore concepts appear in your mind. But they appear in your mind because of the way you are focused in the memory field. In other words, the pebble does not ripple, but the pool ripples when it is hit. That's the nature of the pool.
To include in this memory field the memory of all these concepts which you're not aware of.
Oh, yes. Within that mnemic field, you could include cutting wisdom.
There's no real motion, really.
Well, remember, we've analysed real motion before, the difference between real and apparent. There are definite changes within consciousness. These changes within consciousness are motions, if we care to analyse motion. Because, again, the end function of motion implies a closure. There is a closed system. We sense it. Even if we meet you with a brick, concept will arise in your mind, although the brick isn't a concept. If we smite you on the head with a hammer, concept will arise in your mind. If you press your eye, you see lights. If you poke your ear very hard, you hear a noise.
If you put your finger in your mouth and stimulate certain parts, you will get taste. If you bang yourself on the nose at certain points, you smell a funny smell, and so on. Each organ interprets whatever happens to it within its own form of capacity. So that when thinking arises in you, it does so only because the whole structure of your being, structure means form, has been reverberated by the stimulus. A stimulus is simply adding motion to it. This motion produces resonance system within, and what you are presented with is a series of concepts. Now, what you have to do is look backwards. See these concepts which arise in you as superficial, and feel your own reaction to the stimuli. Feel what it is that mobilizes in you, inhibiting it. And where you are not moving, make it move. Because you know that when I'm sitting here, I can see certain heads go like this at a certain point, and some frown, some go. I can see where they agree and disagree, although they may be unaware of the slight motions, the reflexes, that gives the game away. When you feel yourself about to nod, if you're aware of the causal level, don't. This will change the mode of response by your will. On the other hand, if you find you're going to shake your head, don't do that either. So whether you say yes or no, you deliberately inhibit it. And you inhibit it in order to place yourself at the causal level. The tendency of the thinker, that is of the man, is simply to allow the mind to reverberate when the stimulus comes. And consequently, played out its formal content, and it's always played out. It's always will play out, unless you inhibit it. You have to learn how to stop it when it starts and move it when it won't. This you can only do from the causal level. And you can only do this by going against your inclination. We've had how long since? Well, since the Middle Ages we've had a terrific lot of intellectual discipline. Medieval scholasticism paved the way for the development of the intellect, which in the Renaissance broke through as individual intellectual revolt against authority. This moves forward inevitably to when we come into the 18th century, reason now thinks it can solve the universe. And we find the Spinoza making this error about substance and reducing God to a necessary being, you see, without even defining the word being. And when we go on beyond this, we come into 19th century atomism, still with this intellectual bias, 20th century, and we now meet this strange chimerical figure of science that can't go wrong. So there's a peculiar concept, quite an erroneous concept, that an entity called science exists, which is full of truth. Now, no such entity exists. What we know about individual scientists is that they are often in error about what they say, that even the Nobel Prize winners, who interviewed me the other night, were confessing that they were in teams because they took such twaddle that they needed each other to stop in such twaddle, and the whole process is more or less accidental. It's a sort of determination by each one contradicting the other fellow's contribution. And out of all these mutual contradictions, there gradually emerges a solution that nobody saw. And this is the one that is finally left. And even then they jump on it prematurely and declare there is no blood, there is DNA, and here we have a model of it, and so on. The individual scientist wants to be infallible, because he is basically insecure. If we said, let's go to a university, find all the science students, the ones that want to do science, we find a peculiar characteristic in it, insecurity. Now, pursuing security, objective reality, and they are using the only method that they know of, the empirical, gross materially orientated experimental technique, to try to give themselves a surety that does not exist in the world. And yet they're fundamentally wrongly focused to solve the problem they're trying to solve. There is no security in the time process whatever. Whatever security might mean, it can only refer ultimately to the infinite field, which is the only indestructible. And yet they have built up a myth that there is an entity called science that is never known. And yet this history of science is admittedly the history of exploding hypotheses. All the way along the line, from the very beginning of the science, statements have been made that have been refuted in the next generation. And we know even today, we're always finding new data to explode yesterday's theory. And yet the myth of science carries on. So that people actually think science exists as certainty. They don't understand it as a structure of pure guesses dignified by the general hypotheses. And these guesses are continuously modifying, and the men who are making the guesses are very busy in self-defense because of their inner insecurity, and they boast to their guesses up like mad and argue and have very disgusting exhibitions of the so-called scientific mentality in conflict. Because every time an empirical, practical result emerges, we get claimants from many countries claiming to be the originators of this truth. And the other ones, as if the truth did not exist prior to them, waiting for them to stumble across it. So whatever the training has been, if you give a scientific training to yourself, then when you speak, that on the eardrum, the only thing you've got inside will reverberate is scientific training. And if you give him an art training, then the art will reverberate. And if you give him no training at all and you trust him, then the volitional level will come up and come back. So that all you're getting as a response to whatever he said to you, formally, is the result of vocabulary within you, effectively, is the result of association of emotional experiences you've already had, and volitionally, is very nearly non-existent. It's nearly all there. So you have to first learn to feel yourself as you are responding, then to become free, to be able to decide, cut away, you must learn to stand still so that your nervous field cannot move unless you say so. So that instead of finding yourself automatically shaking your head, which simply means an idea in your mind is non-correspondent with what you believe to be the meaning of the stimulus, or instead of nodding your head, which means you can disagree, you can hear it both of these, and allow the stimulus as motion to come in and find its own place while you watch it. In this process of inhibiting the reaction, you become gradually aware that you are a field of power. The sentient power is your very nature, not form, not just the physical body. And when you feel this, you feel that you have power to assent or dissent to a proposition, independently of whether your organism says yes or no. You can actually learn to contradict yourself by this process of self-realization. And this contradiction, as Blake pointed out, the world is a fiction made of contradiction. Contradiction isn't a bad thing. Contradiction is saying things against things. And out of these contradictions, these against sayings, the universe of form has come into existence. And the whole of society is nothing else but a contradiction. Because each individual is within it for his own ends. And yet his own ends require him to consider every other being's end for whom he has no consideration. And yet without this, there will be no society. When you can affirm these contradictions within society and within yourself, and realize that they are very deeply willed contradictions, then you get onto the causal level where you contradict deliberately instead of mechanically. Then, in Burma's words, the soul gives the lift and nature executes. And so you feel yourself, you feel that you have this power to open and close your own hand. It's exactly in the same order. When I open and close my hand, this we know to be a fact, I have mobilized a field. This was a theory prior to this year. We know it to be a fact now. I mobilize the field to close my hand. This field is simply a zone of influence within the infinite sentient power. The only thing that stops me mobilizing all of it is my own identification with finite, in particular, ambitions. So if I break the tyranny of the finiting process, I can legitimately say all bodies are mine by identifying with the intimate field. But to do this, you must feel. You must realize that the physical act and the act of rationalizing cannot compare it. The real person up to the mystics is simply the logical, cyclic process of thought. Stop it. You won't see to exist. You won't understand less. You'll understand more. The rationalizing cycle in here merely obscures the reality of will and the methods.